are the care compass, pointing hearts back home, turning quiet lonely rooms into places they belong. To the elderly, the wise, you give your steady light, careful care, caring compassion in the soft hours of the night.
Hi, it's Nicole Brandon, and it's wonderful to be with you today. We are working remotely today, so it's exciting to always be able to reach out and to share with you the journey that I am on, the journey that you are on, and that we are forging and taking these roads together, which I think is just knowing you're not alone, for me, has made all the difference in the world. It really has. And it has been a tough week. So I will share with you a little bit about that today. And I have a special and extraordinary guest that is with me today that I feel so very blessed and so very grateful that is joining me. Today we're being joined by Neil Weiser. And Neil, from I've been lucky enough to know Neil almost, I would think, almost my entire lifetime, since I was a very small child. And there are very special people in this world. There are people that are incredibly, remarkably talented, that they have a natural propensity to be able to create, to be able to visualize, to be able to share their gifts and their talents with the world. And then you have people that are just these exemplary people, that are the people that step up and make a difference, people whose lives are changed when you meet them, people who elevate you in their presence, people that you always know that you learn from, that you grow from, that you get challenged by, that you are comforted by, that you are supported by. And then you have people that in their own hearts and their own spirits and souls are just pure gold. They're gold in the way that they treat those around them, the way that they treat the world, the way they treat their family, the way they treat their friends. And I've been lucky enough to know somebody that has all of those qualities in one being, in one man. And Neil is definitely one of my heroes in this world, as well as a dear, dear friend. And he himself has been on a journey with his parents. And I've asked him to come today and to share some of his story, because maybe his story can help you, and what he has been through can help you or guide you in some way through some of the doorways and pathways and challenges that you're facing today. So I feel very blessed and grateful to welcome today Neil Weiser. Neil, thank you so much for being with me.
Oh, it was my pleasure. Thank you so much. And thank you so much for that wonderful introduction. I have tears in my eyes. Thank you so much.
Well, it really is a blessing knowing you. And I had posted on Facebook that I had been going through this very difficult journey with my parents. And you responded to that post with a message that made me have tears in my eyes of your own journey. And sometimes in life, we get so busy as adults, yes, doing our lives and doing our careers and doing our visioning and our dreaming. And then whatever our challenges are, we, you know, we bat them away, that we just take for granted that the people that are in our lives are in our lives. And they're not going anywhere. So we don't check in as often as we should. I think this is a great lesson for everybody, because I certainly would have wanted to be there for you as you were going through your journey. And it meant so much to me that you reached out on mine. So thank you for being my friend. First of all, thank you.
My pleasure.
And knowing that this show is for the other us's. So as a writer, you're a brilliant, talented, find his work, he's a brilliant, talented writer. But for the other people that are going through what you and I are going through, what you have gone through, is there anything that you would like to share or could share that might be able to help others?
I certainly hope so. I mean, everyone's experience is different. They bring different resources, different people who are helping to the table, different circumstances. But I think there's also a lot of commonality in what we're going through, in what is a very difficult time in a person's life, both the people who I think are listening to this program, but also the people who are going through it and the ones who we're caring for. I wish, obviously, you know, everyone says these sorts of things. I wish I knew now what I, you know, when I started this journey. And it is very much a journey. It can take an unpredictable amount of time. And it's hard. And but I hope what I have to say can help.
Oh, I so appreciate it. So I went through, and I'm going through the juggle with two parents. And you similarly had two parents with very different issues at the very same time. And how does one navigate that? How did you navigate that?
I guess for me, I was fortunate enough. First of all, I'm fortunate enough, my wife has been very helpful in this. Although she doesn't practice, she's an attorney, so she brought a lot to the table, which was very helpful. Not that we had a lot of legal issues to deal with, but there's just a lot that happens and a lot that's going on, and you don't expect it. And even when it sneaks up on you and you kind of see it coming, you still don't expect it when it happens. And it's extremely demanding. I apologize if there's noise. There's a gardener next door making
I don't hear him.
noise.
We're listening to your heart. I don't hear any gardeners.
I'll be done in a minute.
It was interesting when we talked, you were talking about your father's journey and that your father tried a new technology. And I know that my dad tried research, cancer medicine that hadn't been used yet, or he could have used another one that had proven side effects, or he could have tried this new medicine. And I know my mom has Crohn's, and both my brother and I were tested, like why we don't have it, and she does, and that research and the thrill of relief or the possibility of relief. And can you talk about that when somebody says this is there might be a solution and the hopes that go with that and then the choices to do something unchartered?
So in my father's case, he had what are essential tremors. And for those of you who don't know what that is, it's an uncontrollable shaking. Actually, my grandmother had it, his mother, when I was young. And she had the Katharine Hepburn version of it where her head shook. And if people are listening on radio or a podcast and not watching, it's an uncontrollable shaking of the head. In the case of my father, it presented itself in uncontrollable shaking of his hands. And I remember since, I guess when he was in his early 50s, I started noticing his hands shaking, but I never, it was just a little bit here and there. It wasn't anything major. But by the time he reached his 70s, his early mid 70s, his hand shaking had spread to both hands and it was uncontrollable. And it just absolutely destroyed his quality of life to the point that I was concerned he may be thinking about taking extreme measures, and don't even really want to elaborate on that. But fortunately, and this was about 10 years ago, the University of Maryland, I don't know how they discovered it, but they were doing a program using what's called focused ultrasound, which sends incredibly precise beams of ultrasonic energy, whatever energy, into the brain, and it can pinpoint and literally zap the affected area of the brain, which is causing the misfire, which is causing the shaking. And my father went through that program. He went through a long period of testing and things because they had to, it was experimental technology, and they had to see if he was a candidate, which he ultimately was. They did a procedure I think it was a 4 hour long procedure where he was conscious on the table. It wasn't, he, they had bolted his head down so that he wouldn't move, but so that the machine could be accurate. But it wasn't a painful type of thing. And during the course of the procedure, they had him write his name. They had him draw simple shapes on paper and stuff. And as they continued with the process, it got better and better with every pass. And to make a long story short, they only did his right hand for starters because it was experimental. He came through with flying colors. It was like 95% successful. And we were very hopeful and looking forward to, in about 6 months, they were going to have him come back and do the other arm. Unfortunately, and some people may cynically snicker at this, but he actually died just a couple months before that process started, and he wound up passing from a series of microstrokes that he had. We do not know whether or not the procedure caused that. And part of the reason, and this actually will build into some of the things that I want to tell people, is that when he passed, he was in the hospital, and the hospital basically, I understand the process, but they needed to get rid of him, if you know what I mean. And so they arranged for him to go, and he was cremated. But I was extremely upset because I wanted an autopsy, not because I was blaming the hospital, but because I wanted the scientists to have that information to determine whether or not what triggered those microstrokes could have been resulting from the procedure and to improve the procedure for future patients. And we weren't afforded that opportunity, which was very hurtful. And it's something that, in your grief, in the shock of it happening, they put papers in front of you, sign this, sign that, whatever. And we never had the option. And that's something that people, one of the many things that as you go through these things that you kind of need to sort of think about, not obsessively, but when these events do happen, it's important for you to keep your head about you and keep your wits about you, which is a very easy thing to say, very different when you're going through it. But it's important that you do so because there's a lot of things that are happening around you, and you need to make the best decisions for you and your family and your loved one at that point.
I'm so sorry that, what an emotional roller coaster for you to be through. I actually was familiar with this research and with this process. My uncle has Parkinson's, and I went online and I saw video after video from, all these different hospitals that were doing this incredible procedure now. And you'd see a violinist that was shaking uncontrollably. And then they would do this surgery, and the fact, like you're saying, that they're awake when they're doing brain surgery, to me was amazing, but they need to know. And then, almost like a garage door opener, they would push a button, or like a remote control on a TV, and all of a sudden, they're like playing this beautiful concerto with absolute control, or a triathlete, or a professor, that's teaching again. And I sent all of these videos. Gosh, I must have sent like 40 or 50 videos to my aunt and uncle and said, these are all the people doing this procedure and you've got to check this out. But he wasn't a candidate because he was so far along in his age at that time. And I was heartbroken because I thought, wow, what a remarkable surgery. So I imagine when your dad had that opportunity, it must be like someone handing you a miracle, right?
Like I said, his quality of life was just collapsing, and I mean, he couldn't eat. He had to drink out of a special cup, and he had to use both hands because he couldn't get the cup and hold it to his mouth long enough to drink out of it. It was horrible. And but those last 6 months, he was like, at least with his right hand, he was almost back to normal, and that restored a significant portion of the quality of life. So I'm glad he had that.
And, talking about that, you would have wanted the research for future people. I think that if we have the opportunity to do that, to pay it forward and to give something, and especially their, new techniques and new technologies, and every day. I was watching the space shuttle that's out there right now, that's like a million bazillion, miles away. And it's like, how did they know where it stops? Like, it took a month to get there. Where's there? How do you know at the end of that month that it's gotten to there? And the fact that we can do so much now, and that those opportunities are available. And so I think that for so many people, they feel there's no hope. There was a woman named Julia Butterfly Hill. And Julia Butterfly Hill was one of the people that lived in the trees during the time when the oil companies were cutting down all of the trees, right? For, in Ecuador and Peru and all these different
Is she the
areas,
one who
and
spent like a year in treetops
in
or
a
something?
tree,
Oh, I heard
yes,
her,
Julia
yeah.
Butterfly Hill. And at one time, they chopped down this tree, and the tree fell, and it killed this young logger named the young boy named David. He was around 19, and he was one of the advocates that was there. And she watched them purposely chop down this tree, and it landed on him, and she watched him die from her perspective. And she said that she was up in that tree, and she was just shaking, and she was crying, and she said, and she felt so hopeless. Like, if they could do that, if they could literally cut down a tree and purposely kill this young boy who's done nothing except try to, protect the forest. And she said, and in that moment, she had a thought, which was, Julia, you have to hope. You can't give up hope, because even if you're the only person in the world with hope, then hope exists on this planet. And I never forgot her saying that. I saw this presentation, and that stuck with me all these years after seeing her. And so, is there anything you can say about that, having that hope?
Well, so I'm a pragmatist and a realist, and it's not that I don't have hope about things. Obviously, I'm a human being, and I do have my hopes and dreams. If I didn't have hope, I wouldn't have been pursuing the careers that I've pursued. As I am, for the audience out there, I'm a writer, and it's an insane career. If you don't have hope, yeah, that's the wrong business to be in. But you need the hope, because it grounds you, and it gives you the belief that there's, how should I put this, the possibility that things can get better. And we all go through terrible periods in our lives. And I'm reminded of a friend who lost two of his four sons prematurely, one from a drug overdose and the other from suicide. And at the funeral for the son who committed suicide, he said that he chose a permanent solution to a temporary problem. And that stuck with me. And I reminded, I'm getting a little emotional over that, but that reminded me. Sorry, I think of that when I'm at my wit's end and I feel like there's no hope, and that all is lost, or how am I going to get out of this, or how am I going to solve this problem? And you have to remember that everything is temporary, and what's important. And I thought about, I was listening to what you were saying as you introduced the story about the journeys that we're on, and life is a journey, and the important thing isn't the end of that journey, although we all hope that it goes that at the end it's graceful and meaningful and comfortable, but it can't be any of these things if the journey is in itself something that you can live with, and live with yourself, and find the joy in the life that you are living. And it's hard. Look, I've been there more than once, and you have to remind yourself of this to keep yourself going. And you have to take care of yourself. Those are the important things, especially, the reason you have to take care of yourself is if you don't take care of yourself, you can't help the people who you're trying to help. So. And it also gives them hope too, when people are in bad conditions, to see someone who's going through it with them, have that hope and have that, find that inner strength. And sometimes they'll get jealous, and sometimes they'll get angry at you. Why are you so strong? How can you handle it when we're both going through this terrible thing? It's each to our own way, and hopefully people who are going through this can remember that and find a little bit of solace and strength from it.
Really beautiful. Thank you. And I want to ask something that's like very difficult to ask. Not that any of this is easy, but I know from my own self, my dad was always like the provider, protector, big, strong, taking care of everybody, dude, right? And what was that like for you when you needed to take care of your dad? And were you able to have conversations? Like closing conversations and emotionally, that journey for you of your dad going through what he was going through.
Well, my dad was a very serious and stern person. He you knew my dad
Knew
very well.
your dad.
And he certainly could enjoy life, but he had to I think he kind of had to actually remind himself to do that, and he didn't remind himself enough. When the end came, I knew there was something wrong. I remember it was a Thursday. I was walking my dog, and I was calling my mom because I usually spoke with my mom. Because when my dad answered, I'd be like, "Hey, what's happening?" He's like, "Yeah, nothing." He'd have simple answers, and then after a minute, he'd be like, "Here, let me give you your mother." And then I would talk to my mom for an hour and a half. And I remember when I called, he answered the phone, and I'm like thinking, "Okay, he's gonna, this will be short," but he sounded very silly. And my dad was not a silly person, and I was happy to hear him making jokes and being silly, and we only still only talked for a few minutes, but it was longer than we usually spoke. But he was like making jokes and just being silly, and that was so unlike my dad, but I was so happy to hear that. And then when I spoke to my mom, she said that there's something going on. She didn't know what was happening, and that he actually was like starting to bump into the walls as he was walking down the hall and stuff. So I said, all right, why don't you take him to the hospital, and I'll come down, and we'll see what's going on. And then the rest is, as I say, is history. So for what happened with my father was rather quick. But immediately thereafter, I found myself in the position where I had to take care of my mother. And that she's still with us. She's in a home now. She's been there for a couple of years, but the process, the first couple of years, we found a rhythm, and she was able to do what she needed to do, and she had a life. But then she started having, as one does when they start getting older. This was when she was around 80. She started developing some progressively more serious issues that required surgery and some other things. But there were other things going on as well, and the things that you expect when a loved one gets older. So she lives about 2 hours away from me, so I don't see her every day. But when I would go down and see her every other week or so. I'd be like, "Mom, why does the car have a ding in it? Mom, what? A week later, "Hey, Mom, why does the car have another ding in it?" Stuff like that. And the signs were there, and eventually we had to have her driver's license taken away. And but it was during that period that we discovered that she was suffering from early stages of Alzheimer's. And that just open up a whole new chapter for what that the implications of that, what it meant, and what things that we needed to do, and the difficulty of caring for a loved one who was now living alone. But there were some additional challenges in her instance because she lived in a resort community. She I grew up in, as Nicole did as well, in one of the suburbs of Atlantic City, which when we were there was a lot of people, and it was a small but thriving community. But at this point, the population has dwindled significantly. And even though my mother lived on a major road, her peer group was shrinking because people moved away and passed, and it was getting harder and harder, and became an extremely challenging thing to navigate. I had no experience with this. I have two brothers, one who lives near her, but for his own reasons is not involved. And my other brother wants to be involved, but he lives up near me, which is 2 hours away. So it became a challenge, and finally got to the point where we recognized that she needed to move someplace where they could care for her better. And we did that, and ultimately, she when they invited her into, we found a community. We looked at many, but we found one near her. Other would have preferred it up here, but some of her peers were there. And she, when she was initially invited, she didn't want to go in. So right away, which I had to respect that decision. We went through the process of trying to find nurses to come over for a few hours a day and take care of her, and that was one nightmare after another. It's challenging to find, you know, the old saying, it's challenging to find good help, you know. And it's really a shame because the two women that we had, they both started, the first weeks were great. Then after that, it was not. And you know, they behaved, basically they behaved themselves the first week, and then they started taking advantage, and it was a bad situation. I was constantly you know, it's a 2-hour ride each way, so I'm constantly going down there, and I couldn't stay over every time I went down there, so it'd be another 2 hours back. And you know, you work, you have life, the life that you have to live, you got a kid you have to take care of, and it makes it hard, and you have to find, the only way to get through it is to find a balance and take care of yourself, as I mentioned earlier. But that is, I wish I had done a better job taking care of myself. I just kind of like when this when these things happen, I just kind of like switched on. I was like, okay, we have an emergency here. It needs to be solved. And I actually I used to be a lifeguard, and I was almost an EMT at one point. I'd started going through a lot of training for that, so I had learned how to handle myself in emergency situations and life-threatening situations. And thank God I had that, because if I didn't have that training, I don't know what would have happened. I would have flipped out more than once and frequently. But you know, you have to just stay calm, stay rational, and it is not easy, but I want to let everyone out there know that they can do that. They have the strength. You are strong enough to find the strength to keep yourself a little more balanced, take care of yourself a little bit better than you do. Don't berate yourself, don't blame yourself, don't abuse yourself. Certainly, you know, having a beer every once in a while is fine. But, you know, take care of yourself, keep it under control, because you are only for the 5 or 10 minutes or the hour that you feel better, you're going to have days and weeks and months that are going to be worse because of it. And you have to find that inner strength. And I know you have that out there. I did not know that I had it. And it's a little difficult for me to speak about it even now. But it's there. It's there. So you don't have to take the special courses and do the research, but the information is out there. Find a few sources. It's very easy to get overwhelmed with, and that this is something that I do a lot, is like when I have a problem and I research it, I research the hell out of it, and I look for all these different sources. And really what I'm doing is, well, I think I'm making progress. What's actually happening is I'm getting a lot of information at a very high level, but I'm not getting enough focused information to and practice to allow me to solve and do better at the problems that I presented. It took me a long time to realize that. And so just find a few good resources, occasionally find another one or, you know, two, you know, things like that. But just put it into practice and take it easy. You don't have to do everything all at once, even though you'll sometimes feel frantic and you have to do everything all at once. You know, there's a lot that's going to go on. There's a lot of moving pieces, and you know, just pick and choose the ones that you can solve now, or if there's a deadline, like if you're applying for Medicaid or Medicare and things like that. I mean, those programs are not easy to navigate, and it's hard. And but just stay persistent, and you'll get through this.
I'm so glad that you said that, because you did what I didn't do. You took care of you. You know, I dove in. I gave up my career. I gave up my life. I gave up my health. You know, I got sick. Like, I days and days and days, just sleeping in the hospital and not letting go. And every time I would turn around, I was afraid to cross the street because they might need something. And so it's didn't talk to my friends, didn't talk to me. Like I literally just focused on them. And then all of a sudden you're like, okay, where did what happened? I feel like I'm far away from the center of me, right? Trying to pull myself back into myself, which I would not recommend if I had it to do over again. There are no do-overs in life, but I would do what you said. I remember seeing that, I forget who said the quote, but it's not whether the glass is half full or half empty. It's the fact that the glass is refillable.
Great quote.
Right. And the fact that I didn't keep refilling my cup, I just got to that deplete level. And then there was like squeak, squeak, there's nothing there. And I just kept making it go out instead of that refilling that energy and refilling the joy and refilling the laughter and the happiness and, whatever that is. So I love that you're sharing this information, with their friends that are listening because it is important. And listen to Neil, it's so important. And I wish I listened to the show 2 years ago to know how important that really is.
I mean, it's just like going to work every single day. You can't do a good job at work if you feel terrible. And certainly there are going to be days where you are going to feel terrible. There's no way around it. It's just a part of life. But, you take the time, you decompress over a weekend, you do the things that you do so that you can go to your job. Hopefully you love your job. I know not everyone does. And I certainly had many of those jobs where it's just like, you hate your job, you hate your boss, you hate your life, whatever. But you got to remember that you got to keep the balance because, unfortunately, maybe it's more today than previously, but it's kind of a cruel world out there. It's hard. And it's harder than it seems like it's harder than it used to be. And my father-in-law developed ALS, and they were able they had the resources to hire a permanent nurse, but it took a hell of a long time to find the right one. And he survived with it for about 10 or 11 years before finally passing. And that was a nightmare. And going through that, and especially for such a long period of time, and his quality of life last couple of years was absolutely terrible. And it would have been, well, he wouldn't have lasted that long if he didn't have the medical help that he had. But you're a part of that, and you and one of the things that this particular nurse, who's been like a member of the family since then, she actually was looking out at and looking after everyone else as well. And she would pull me aside and ask me how I was doing, and could see that I was having trouble and stuff. And I was like, don't worry about me. Take care of him. Take care of my wife and everything like that. And she pulled them aside in her own time and in ways as well too. But the incredible thing was that during this 10-year period, this is a guy who had a lot of friends. And little by little, over that time period, especially as he got worse, when he needed them the most, they mostly disappeared. And that happens because people get scared. People see, especially if they're in the same age group or what have you. He was in his late 60s, and they see their own mortality. Maybe, I mean, people have their own reasons for doing the things that they do, and it's. You have to look out after you and your loved one, and hopefully you'll have friends and family there to support you and to share the burden and to help you solve problems. Some will help a lot, some will help very little, but it's important that if they're there, be grateful for it, even if it's just a little bit. You're going to have moments of terrible anger and rage that this person or that person isn't doing enough, and you can't put you don't know what they're going through, and it's not healthy to fixate on it. You just kind of need to accept it, as horrible as that may seem. I'm not talking about forgiveness. That's a completely different discussion. but you need to accept what they are going to do and aren't going to do, and then just keep working the problem and solving the problem and take care of yourself. And I can't say that enough, how vital it is to take care of yourself, because your energy, what you're bringing to your loved one when you're dealing with them, they pick up on it and it affects them as well. And they can tell, you know, they know when you're happy and sad. They know when you're bothered, and it's not going to help them one bit if they see you're stressed out. I'm not saying walk in, you know, with, you know, being like a clown and everything like that, unless that's your personality, which is great, you know, because laughter is a wonderful, wonderful medicine, and that helps. And it's important that you try to remember to laugh once in a while. So.
Great advice. And I wanted to go back and just touch on one thing that you said about your mom denting the car.
Yeah.
So I know what I went through with my dad. He could drive. Do you think I can't drive? And give me, the, you know, we had to like hide the keys. And, you know, it was a struggle. Like, and do you have that with your mom, or did she just go, oh, I understand, I shouldn't be driving anymore?
There was some of that. The challenge was so the stores that, like the local grocery store and things like that, there's a cluster that's about 6-7 blocks away. And you might think, oh, it's only 6-7 blocks away. But when you're an 80-year-old woman and it's bitter cold out, and you live in a community where on some streets you might have one car drive down a street once every week or something. And, you know, like I would tell her, you know, call, and she wasn't great with a cell phone, so that was an added challenge. But we would tell her, you know, like, if you can't stay on the phone with us while you're walking, at least call us when you get back. And then it was like, okay, stick to the main road, because the road that she lived on was like this main artery. So there was a fair amount of traffic, but you go around the block, and like I said, I mean, there might be one car a day, and God forbid something would happen, no one's going to find you for a while. And, you know, plus the sidewalks aren't level and she's not walking straight anyway and stuff. And it gets to the point where it gets kind of terrifying. And the car is freedom, especially for people who may live in rural areas. You know, you don't have a car, that's it. You're marooned, you're stranded. And it's hard, but you know, you've got to think of not only their safety, but the safety of other people around. And we knew it was going to be a challenge when she couldn't drive anymore. And for about a year or two, she had some friends who were happy to take her when they would go food shopping, they'd pick her up. But, you know, unfortunately, those friends were of the same peer group and age group, and were suffering from their own issues. And one moved away, and one who was just the nicest woman in the world. But the problem was with her was that she had serious mental issues, and she meant well, and I loved her, and she was a great, nice woman, but she drove everyone crazy. And I got to the point where my mother just couldn't deal with her anymore. Yeah, God bless her though. But you know, these are the things in life that you have to deal with. And you know, fortunately today we've got things like DoorDash and stuff like that, so that helped a little bit. Obviously gets very expensive very soon, and between my one brother and I, we tried to make sure that one of us would see her, if not once a week, once every other week. So there was people there, but we spoke to her every day, and sometimes two or three or more times a day. And it's important because they need to maintain that connectivity, and especially when you're dealing with people who are isolated. That's a really bad thing. It's not just their physical danger and well-being, it's their mental and emotional well-being. And I remember visiting my mom once towards the end of her, when she was at the house. She would hear a noise or something, a car going by, and it would make a different noise than a car would or whatever. And she would run to the front door to see what was going on. And I realized it was because she had such a lack of social stimulation that she was thinking, oh, is it a friend of mine I could say hi to, you know, things like that. And in the summer, it was much easier because she used to sit on the porch all the time. And as people would go by, you know, they would wave and stuff, and many people would stop and talk to her. And it was great. But during the winter, you go through months after months after months, aside from just the bitter cold, you know, with the weather of her being stuck inside, and that is not healthy. And that created, it was a form of, I kind of thought of it as a form of torture. And it was something that I could see was negatively affecting her, not only emotionally, but physically as well. And it was increasing her, what's lacking a better word? Degradation, it's not a great word. But she was becoming more frail and such. And I could see it happening. And fortunately, when we were able to move her into this facility, she was among her peers. It's been a little bit of a roller coaster. There are times when she loves it, but all of a sudden, the woman who was her friend in high school that she knew before all these years, and they totally reconnected when she moved in. It was wonderful. This woman was funny, and but she had her own challenges and her own issues. And then one day, she was gone, and my mother, because of her Alzheimer's, just kind of she knew there was something missing, but she couldn't put her finger on it. And in a way, that curse was a little bit of a blessing in that context, because this woman who she knew since childhood, who was a friend, and with whom she reconnected, was gone, but my mother didn't remember her really being there. So you gotta take it's gonna sound weird to say it. You gotta take your wins where you can find it. And we're in a situation now where, mom has a boyfriend, but my mother's now 86 and he's 93, and very nice man. I like him a lot. He's got a great sense of humor. And one of the wonderful things is whenever I see them together, and or when she calls and he's around, they are always laughing. And that has brought so much vitality back to her life. But he's 93 and he just spent 2 or 3 weeks in the hospital. I don't know what happened. He's back in the facility, but I know he's having trouble. And the reality is the reality. And soon he may no longer be there. And my mother, when he was in the hospital, didn't know where he was and was upset and angry. But given a little bit of time, because of the nature of the disease, she was starting to forget. And eventually, when things happen, I'm concerned what's going to happen to my mother when he disappears, and she's not going to have that companionship and not going to have that laughter. But I know that that aspect of it may not last very long. So you just have to take it one day at a time. And the fact that they crack each other up, which just
I love that. I love that
it
she has
is
that in
so,
her life right now, and
yeah.
those sparks of joy and the beautiful moments, and there's nothing like companionship and friendship
Yeah.
and blessings in our lives. Now, I've got a question totally unrelated because you're talking about freedom, right? And you're talking about win-wins. What is NASA behind you?
When so my audience, the people, if you're on the radio again, I've got a couple of framed things behind my desk. When social media exploded, I helped NASA get their social media game in order, and they invited me to a space shuttle launch, and I met a bunch of astronauts. And actually, one of them, there's a little piece there in the frame. There's actually a piece of the space shuttle Discovery that flew in 1984, so they gave that to me as a thank you for helping them. So completely unrelated, but I stick it behind my desk, not so it could be on the podcast, but because when I walk in facing my desk, and I like seeing it when I walk in. So, and say, so it's funny. The funny thing is,
Really?
whenever when people mention it, I always forget it's behind me, even though on the screen I can see it's behind me, but it's there every day. I don't look at it like that,
That's really cool. I think that's amazing. And then on the business side, so you're a writer. You're
Yes.
brilliant, genius,
Thank
spectacular,
you.
remarkable, compelling, seat-edging writer. You
Thank
really
you.
are. You're
Thank you.
brilliantly talented. Has this journey with your parents changed characters? Like now, when you're writing people, do you have characters that you hadn't
Yes.
created before because of this journey?
Yes, in fact, I just recently was commissioned and just delivered it 2 days ago a script for a short film that's going to go in production over the summer. And one of the characters is in his early 70s, is a grandfather. And the story is about how the different generations, especially now with Gen Alpha, they have such a unique way of speaking that it's almost like a separate language. And in some ways it really is a different language. And he's a boomer. The one granddaughter is she's kind of borderline between millennial and being Gen Z, and the other one is Gen Alpha, and they're actually sisters. And something happens in the story and they wind up each speaking their own language full of all the phrases and colloquialisms that they have, but it sort of describes how sort of shows how they can't communicate, and they have to figure out a way to communicate with each other to solve a problem. And it's a funny little thing. And the grandfather, in one of the early scenes, he's talking with the older granddaughter about the younger one, who's just got is just full of sass and attitude, and he can't communicate with her. And but at one moment during the conversation, because the younger girl has to stay with him, he says that he confesses. The granddaughter says, "How are things going?" And he's like, "You know what? Yeah, things are getting harder. I remember, I can remember everything that happened, with incredible detail from when I was a kid, and when I was married to your grandmother, and so on and so forth. But I can't remember if I tied my shoes this morning, and I have to look and, see if they're tied." And that's something I would have never been able to write had I not gone through these life experiences of happening. And not that I am grateful about that, but you live life, you learn, you try to apply the things that you learn in a positive sense, in a positive way to your life. And fortunately, I can express that in my writing, and I think it has brought a lot of depth to characters who I just couldn't really write before.
Brilliant answer. I love that. I have used to have a neighbor, and he had dementia. He didn't know his last name. He was Bill, and they would find him wandering down the street, and the police would come and bring him back. He didn't know where he lived. He didn't know his last name, but he used to be a singer, and he was still in a group called the Fifth Dementias, and they knew the lyrics to every song, and they would go perform. He only knew he was Bill, but he knew his music.
Well, the insidious thing about Alzheimer's is that it doesn't affect the areas of the brain that have already produced memories. And however, I mean, I'm fascinated by the brain, but I'm very technically proficient and stuff. But when it comes to certain things, I just don't understand the chemistry of how those chemical combinations put patterns down in your brain that are memories. But when you have Alzheimer's, your brain can't do that anymore, or at least it can't do that efficiently. And it's important to understand when your relatives are sick that, they're going through something too, obviously. But it helps if you kind of keep in mind what it is that they're going through, because they're human beings too, and they don't understand what's happening to them, or maybe they do understand, but they're afraid, and they're looking at you for strength, and they're looking at you for love. And it's hard, but you've got to find the strength and the love in there to help them, because that will help them more than you can possibly imagine. I go to my mother's home, and where she's living now, the assisted living facility, and I see all these other people there. Some people I have gotten to know, and I know that they don't have family come visit them ever. And the lone and some don't and friends, they don't have friends anymore. Their friends have passed or whatever. And the loneliness that these people are experiencing is just heartbreaking. And fortunately, she's in a good facility. And not that every facility is perfect, there are issues, but it's a community in there. But it's also an ever-changing community, because people come and go, and for a variety of reasons. And they're all in different stages of the last chapters and of their lives. And it's important that they be able to have friendships and stuff. And understanding that, and knowing that, and understanding what they're going through will help you take care of them better.
It's wonderful. And so I know we're coming up to the top of the hour, and Do you have any last words of wisdom or advice or for somebody that's listening today and that's either just setting on this journey or that has been on this journey or
Yeah,
it's a lot, you know.
I was thinking about, I kind of knew you were going to ask that question. So I was thinking about what I would say. And I've actually been having conversations with friends recently about these, because now there's some friends are starting to deal with similar issues. And, you know, remember that it's hard for everyone. And, you know, we've already spoken about taking care of yourself, which is so important, and being good to yourself. And look, you're going to make mistakes. You're going to sit down one night and think, I'm just going to have one glass of wine and then I'll be fine. And, you know, I'll go to bed early. And then, you know, before you know it, the bottle's empty and stuff. All right. It happens. Don't beat yourself up over it. If you make mistakes taking care of your parents, don't blame yourself. Don't beat yourself up over it. It is life. None of us are perfect. And unfortunately, the way our society is built today, it isn't built to help people who are both senior citizens and in those stages of life. And it's not built to help people who are trying, the families who are trying to help these people. I when I started having to learn about Medicaid and Medicare, and especially Medicaid, the hoops I had to jump through for my mother, it was a nightmare. And I learned a lot, and I learned a lot fast, and I had, because I had no choice, and it was hard, and it affected my job, and it affect. I also do I'm marketing executive when I'm not writing, and it seriously affected my job in a negative way. And but I wasn't taking care of myself, as I mentioned earlier, as I can now. It's still hard, you know. Every day when I talk to my mom, sometimes I just, I can't take it, but I have to make her laugh, because I know if she's laughing, then she's okay. And then that takes a little bit of the pressure off of me. Like I said, it's a lot of stuff, a lot of things that you'll have to do. I would strongly advise to start having these conversations with your loved ones as soon as you can. Simply because, and a lot of people aren't aware of this, I have a friend who's going through this. Her mother, used to be wealthy, but is not anymore, but she still has a beautiful house, but they're now going to move her into the same facility where my mother is. This is a friend who I grew up with. And what happened is that because of what's going on in the state laws, they're going to probably have to sell, surrender the house to the facility, and the facility will sell it to finance the mother's residency there. I was fortunate, and in so much as in 2011, my father actually changed the deed of the house and put it in my brother's and my name, because there was a look back period. He knew that eventually he would, well, he didn't make it, but he would eventually go to a senior's facility. And for New Jersey, where he lived, it was a 5-year look back period at the time. So by the time my mother went, it had been like 8 years or so. And or it was more than that, actually. And so we didn't have to surrender the house. Not that it's a mansion or anything like that. It's a very small, very old house. We're fortunate to have it, because when we go down there to see her, we have a place to stay. So I don't have to drive for 4 hours. And, you know, on a day when I just want to go visit her for an hour, you know, or unfortunately, we can't take her out to lunch anymore. But we used to go down and take her to lunch and, you know, try to have maybe take her shopping when she was feeling up to it, stuff like that. But my point is that your family members, many of them will resist those conversations for their own reasons. Some of them are just frightened. Some of them are ignorant. And let me rephrase that, not ignorant, ignorant in the terms of they just don't know. Not that they're stupid, but they don't know what needs to happen. They don't know these programs. Oh, only old people who can take care of themselves are on these programs. It's hard. And find a way to get through it and do the necessary preparations. You don't have to do everything all at once. But in the instance of this, for example, my friend did not know about that 5-year look back program, and they're going to lose the house because of it. And she lives in Philly. And it's an hour and a half away. So when she goes to visit her mother, she's not going to be able to stay over, because there's not going to be a house for her to stay at. So these are going to be hard conversations. Sometimes, like my father was like, my money is my money. It's none of your business what I have or don't have. It's like, you're going to become like that. Find a way, be gentle about it, be understanding about it. Let them understand that it's not just them. Some of them may not have the resources that you think that they have or that they led you to believe they have. And so there's a tremendous amount of embarrassment and guilt about that. So be understanding, take it slow, but get started. Get those things with your estate in order.
That's really the thing. Get started, be good to yourself, be kind to yourself, and you're not alone. That's the whole thing about this show. You are not alone. You are doing great. I'm so proud of you. Neil is so proud of you. We are walking side by side. Send me an email, Nicole at Nicole Brandon Worldwide. If you have a question, if there's something, I will find the right expert for you. I promise you, I will do everything I can to bring all of the answers to your door. But most importantly, just know that you are not alone. You are supported. You are loved. And we are grateful for you. And Neil, I am grateful for you for joining
Thank you.
me
I'm
today. And
grateful
I
for you
love
for
to
helping
your
me help
mom.
these people.
And we look forward to seeing you on Care Compass. And again, we are walking together in support and in love.
Yeah.
Thank you for being with me today.
It was my pleasure.
You are the care compass, pointing hearts back home, turning quiet lonely rooms into places they belong. To the elderly, the wise, you give your steady light, careful care.